This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a women's rights activist from a country where many women see the world from behind a veil. Bapsi Sidhwa has been a social worker in Pakistan and was her country's representative to the Asian Women's Congress in 1975. Sidhwa is also one of Pakistan's most popular novelists and one of the first to be published internationally. Her latest novel, Cracking India, was published last year in the States by Milkweed Editions. This fall, Milkweed reprinted her first novel, The Crow Eaters. Cracking India is set in the late 40s, after England pulled out of India, and the country was divided into predominantly Hindu India and predominantly Muslim Pakistan. Sidhwa was 9 at the time of the partition, and she remembers the atmosphere of violence and betrayal as Muslims, Hindus, Parsis, and Sikhs fought among themselves. As a Parsi, she was part of a minority group. The Parsi religion has under 500,000 followers in the whole world. The novel is semi-autobiographical, told from the perspective of an 8-year-old Parsi girl. Here's a short reading.
There is much disturbing talk. India is going to be broken. Can one break a country? And what happens if they break it where our house is? Or crack it further up on Waris Road? How will I ever get to Godmother's then? I ask cousin. Rubbish, she says. No one's going to break India. It's not made of glass. I ask Aya. They'll dig a canal, she ventures. This side for Hindustan and this side for Pakistan. If they want two countries, that's what they'll have to do. Crack India with a long canal. Gandhi, Jinnah, Nehru, Mountbatten are names I hear. And I become aware of religious differences. It is sudden. One day, everybody is themselves. And the next day, they are Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Christian. People shrink, dwindling into symbols. Aya is no longer just my all-encompassing Aya. She's also a token, a Hindu.
Were you frightened when the country was partitioned?
As a child, I have memories of chants, you know, of mobs chanting in the distance, which were very threatening sounds. I felt they threatened the people I held dear. And I saw fires. It wasn't like a fire display to me. It really was threatening. It was like blood was splashed in the sky. And, of course, all the time there was talk around me of what was happening to our friends and neighbors who were at that time Hindu and Sikh who were leaving and new refugees arriving. And I saw dead bodies on my Waris Road where I lived.
That's pretty terrifying.
As a child, yes, these sounds more than anything else terrified me.
In your novel, Cracking India, Aya, who is the nursemaid of the main character, the woman who cares for the child, she is kind of destroyed at the end by Muslims because she is a Hindu in Muslim Pakistan. Did you know people who were in that position, people who were close to you?
Not people who were close to me, but I grew up with stories about what happened to so-and-so's sister, mother, daughter, brother, father. Now, these were accounts recited by Muslim refugees because I was in Lahore. One of the most terrible aspects of the partition was that hundreds of thousands of women were kidnapped, Hindu women and Sikh women by Muslims, and Muslim women by Hindus and Sikhs. It's sort of very true of our part of the world that when you have to celebrate a victory, the victors do so on the body of a woman. And when you want to get rid of the feeling of humiliation at a defeat, there again you humiliate your enemy's women by raping them, etc. So the women were the major targets when it came to power play, humiliation, and celebration in this part of the world. So it was Hindu, Muslim, Sikh women, all of who suffered.
When you say they were kidnapped, where were they taken?
They were kidnapped by individuals, taken into their homes, raped, and then sold for 10 rupees each, 20 rupees each, which is less than a dollar, you know. People would be shouting in the streets, apparently, that zanana for sale, zana for sale. You know that women are being sold, and that's the price, 10 rupees for a woman.
When you became a woman, did you meet women who had been kidnapped and sold years before?
I may have met them, but you know, this is something, it's considered so dishonorable and so defiling that women would not openly talk about it. Other women would whisper about it. And as a child, I would just catch innuendos and whispers about various women. Where I was living, right next door to me, was a camp for recovered women. These were the women who were kidnapped and then recovered after the partition from various places and brought to these camps. And we as children used to go onto our roof and peek into this camp and look at these very despondent, very poor sort of looking women who didn't talk much. I mean, now with my adult's imagination, I can understand what happened to them. But as a child, I couldn't grasp it. And the sad thing was that a lot of these women were not accepted back by their families because women are supposed to embody honor. You know, they're vessels for honor. And they had been dishonored, so the families didn't want them back into their households. And they were left to fend, you know, by a little training in embroidery and to eke out their lives like that.
You were married at the age of 19. You had three children. You've described yourself as having been an upper middle class housewife. Your husband was a businessman. How did you start becoming involved with women's rights?
This is very strange, actually. I read this book, The Female Eunuch, by Germaine Greer. This must be when I was about 25, 26. And I just got up the next day a totally different person, very aggressive, fighting with my husband, having temper tantrums all around, you know, till I decided I shouldn't read books like that. But that gave me an awareness of, well, why was I so submissive and why was I so accepting of taking the secondary place and being so subservient to other people, whether it was my father, mother, or husband. And then I got involved in social work, and gradually my interest in what was happening to women developed, and also my awareness of what was happening to women. I started doing a lot of social work with destitute women's homes, with orphanages, and there I came across instances which really sort of left their stain on me, and I wanted to do something about it.
When you say that you were tired of being subservient to your parents and to your husband, what was the typical middle-class marriage like in Pakistan or at the time? When you talk about subservience, what do you mean?
Well, you know, you are always waiting for your husband. You're more or less a public relations officer to your husband, entertaining for him all the time, taking phone calls. If you go out in a car, you're the one who's waiting endlessly for him to do his work and come in. And you take everything in your stride. You're told this evening so many people are coming, or this day so-and-so is coming, or keep the house ready, we're expecting so many visitors, or at the drop of the hat, let's travel. I mean, you totally sort of sublimate your life for your husband's existence, before that for your parents' existence. These are very little things, and they're not very demanding, but in the end, they accumulate and make for a great demand on one's time.
When you started working with destitute women, did you start becoming aware of the class differences and how women were treated in your country?
Yes, the class difference is there enormously. Among the very poor, the women don't observe the veil, and they work in the fields with the men, except, of course, the village leader's wife. She would observe parda. And her work is not really accounted for in terms of cash. You know, it's free labor. And then when they enter the middle class, interestingly enough, at this point, the woman says, okay, now I'm better off, so I'll go in behind the veil. I'll wear a veil. So it is a status symbol that now my wife does not need to work. We are better off. Then as you get to the much richer classes, then it is the women they don't observe the veil, except if they're in very narrow-minded villages, if their husbands happen to be in the mountain villages, you know, sardars or lords out there. And these women have more or less the freedom of a wife in America, perhaps. So the class does make a great difference. And then when I was working in the destitute women's homes, that's when I became aware what had happened. And it's a strange thing that in Pakistan, men outnumber the women. And in these destitute women's, in the home I was working, there were a lot of women with children. By 19, a woman has produced perhaps 4 children. And if there were 25 women in the home, there would be about 300 men wanting to marry them. And once or twice I realized that perhaps there was something wrong going on, because I saw a dwarf and a very sort of cruel-looking man getting married to a very beautiful young woman of 19. And after that, my friends and I decided that we would interview each of the bridegrooms before something like that happened. And we would interview the bridegrooms to find out what they wanted to marry for. Most of them said, oh, you know, we have so many chickens, we have so many goats, we have so many sacks of wheat, and we have nobody to look after it because my wife died. And then we'd say, but you don't want a wife, you just want a free servant. And if a man showed some inclination to romance, that, look, I've had nobody to arrange my marriage because I've been busy for this reason or that reason, and I would like to get married and have a home of my own, then we would introduce the woman, or at least let them have a look at each other and arrange a marriage between them.
Did you ever wear the veil yourself?
Just as a teenager once, to see what it felt like, I borrowed the veil of one of my friend's mothers and I walked on the street. It was a sort of a adventure.
So how did it feel?
Well, you know, it's a black thing and you wear it from top to bottom. You wear it like a skull cap over the head and it flows right down to your feet. And you feel a little cramped and it's mysterious because there's netting in front and you look out through that. The world does seem a little hazier. Your movements are constricted. It certainly, I think, shifts you into a different dimension, into a different world, a more cramped world, constricted world.
Do you see religion as an anti-feminist force in Pakistan?
Not the religion itself, but the way it is practiced and the way the mullahs and particularly the fundamentalists interpret it. Sometimes I feel they use religion as something with which to browbeat women and make them more subservient. God knows they're subservient enough and still they're not satisfied. And they certainly use religion to do so. But a lot of Pakistani women feel they ought to interpret religion according to their lights and the Quran according to their lights, and they feel they'd come up with a different interpretation.
My guest is Pakistani novelist Bopsy Sidhwa. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Pakistani novelist and women's rights activist Bopsy Sidhwa is my guest. You've explained how you went from being a middle-class homemaker to being a women's rights advocate. How did you become a writer? How did you start writing?
I came across it very accidentally. I'd never written before. And when I was about 28, 29, I visited a remote part of Pakistan in the Karakoram Mountains, which is under total tribal jurisdiction. And the tribes there are so locked into the mountains that they really live in the Stone Age still. They literally live in caves. And I heard the story of a young girl who had been married there and had run away from a husband. And these people think a runaway, if a wife runs away, it's an intolerable insult to the husband. And the whole clan was out hunting her, and eventually these infallible hunters. And they found her near the Indus River just before she could be rescued, and they severed her head from her body. When I heard the story in this very beautifully spectacular country in the northern areas, when I came back to Pakistan, I wanted to tell the story of this girl because it did reflect the lives of quite a few women in a way. And I did want to describe the beauty of the scenes I'd seen and the tribals. I mean, they were a very romantic people in a way. And I sat down to write what I thought was a short story. And before I knew it, it was turning into a novel, and it became my first novel, which was called The Bride, and now is known as The Pakistani Bride.
You live part of the time in Pakistan and part of the time in the United States.
Yes, lately I've been doing that.
Is it hard to get your work known outside of your country? I know, for instance, your new novel, Cracking India, was first published in England, or at least it was published in England before it was published in the States. Uh-huh. Is it hard to get your work known internationally?
Oh, very hard. If you're living in Pakistan and you write in English, I think I'm the very first to be published abroad. or maybe among the very few. I'd written both the novels, The Pakistani Bride and The Crow Eaters, and although they were accepted by Curtis Brown in America, they were at that time agents, the poor people showed it around to every publisher for about 3 years. And also they sent it to their agents in Britain, and both the books were getting rejection slips, any amount of rejection slips from both sides of the Atlantic. And it was a heartbreaking process for me. I stopped writing for about 6 years in between. So before I could get published, it had taken about 10 years for me to be published abroad. Before that, I was published in Pakistan. And then I was published in Britain and then in America.
Is there a sense among publishers abroad, well, who cares about Pakistan? Who understands Pakistan? Our readers won't want to know.
Precisely. That's what most of the rejection slips said, that though we love the work, we feel Pakistan is too remote in time and space, and who will be interested in it? Unfortunately, in our very competitive market, we don't feel the book will be monetarily, help. It won't make money.
What do you have a large readership in Pakistan, proportionately?
A very large readership. I would be considered in the absolute bestseller racket. I've had the honor of being pirated, and they're very peculiar versions of my books floating around. I don't mind because they sell cheap and they're read, so I'm quite happy.
Are they controversial in your country?
We were expecting The Bride to be controversial, but it wasn't for some reason. And that is why The Crow Eaters was published first, because it was mainly a comedy about the Zoroastrians, which tell you everything about my community as well. But that is the novel which became very controversial. My community took great exception to it. They felt I'd let out secrets that I shouldn't have, and they felt threatened because they were a minority. It was strange because I'd written it out of great affection. But now that I've received from Pakistan what is a very high civilian award called the Sitara-e Pakistan, my community suddenly accepts me and my writing, You need somebody else to accept you, and then your own community accepts you.
Right, because then you make them look good.
Yeah, maybe. At one point, not so good, and then suddenly good.
What are the things about the status of women that you would still like to see changed in Pakistan?
Oh, my God, a lot of things, most of the things. I would like them, first of all, to get education, to get more control of money, more control of their lives. I certainly would like to see any brother, husband, or father who kills his wife to be just hung. I mean, I'm absolutely for capital punishment when it comes to that. Because brothers and fathers think it is their right, if they feel their sister is flirting or has had a secret affair, even with her fiancé, they feel quite justified in killing her. This is, of course, again, we are talking of a class, the peasant class, the poorer classes. And just every sort of zulm, now I'm trying to think, every sort of bullying tactic is used on women, and women are supposed to accept it. And I think I would like to see a lot changed.
Any impressions of the women's movement in the United States?
Yes, of course. I've experienced it, but it's a totally different breed of feminist movement here. Their priorities are different. And their way of handling issues are different. I think there's this huge cultural difference which makes us to react to different things in different ways.
What do you see as the main difference between how the American women's movement handles issues as compared to what you're used to?
It seems to me that they have probably resolved some issues, and their priorities have shifted to things which, at this point, because our problems are so enormous, seem to us a little trivial. And we want to be fighting for things where women are in constant physical danger, physically being kidnapped from many parts of the countries to be used in prostitution, and the society turns a blind eye towards it. Whereas some of the issues like, I don't want to really name them, because I don't know in what context they fit into the American woman's consciousness. But I know there are some serious problems women face here, and they have to keep struggling against it too.
Kidnapping is still an issue in Pakistan?
Yes, because not only kidnapping, but in the northern areas, the races are very white, pale-colored, and they're extremely poor. So people buy girls there, and they put them into prostitution or, you know, all sorts of slavery and things like that. So that is the form of kidnapping. There are other forms of kidnapping, too. I mean, women, for some reason, because of the segregation in the society or whatever the factor, they are, in a way, a desirable commodity. It's the opposite of India, where a woman pays a dowry to get married. In Pakistan, the husband pays the bride's father, this is in the northern areas of Pakistan, to get a bride. So a woman is like a commodity. She's worth money. So women are kidnapped for several reasons.
Are you still married, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Has it been hard to change so much and keep a marriage together?
We've come to a comfortable relationship. Of course, the marriage pattern did change several times, and particularly after we moved to the States. But I think, you know, living in the society we did in Pakistan, naturally a lot of the values of Pakistan had been absorbed, which could not be sustained in America, where the atmosphere for a woman is a lot freer. And I chafed at some of the things. And my husband also changed a lot of his thinking in this different atmosphere. And we have come down to a much more comfortable relationship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Bapsi Sidhwa's latest novel, Cracking India, and her first novel, The Crow Eaters, are published in the States by Milkweed Editions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.